antenna in the world is a parabolic dish. In the past, the biggest antenna in the world in gain number was the 200-inch Mount Palomar telescope, optical telescope. The reason it has so much gain is because it's using optical wavelengths where the wavelengths are so small that really that 200-inch diameter is thousands and thousands of wavelengths in diameter. That's what determines the gain, how much real estate, how many wavelengths of stuff you're using. So the combination of very high frequency and a very big parabola, very accurately made to the nearest millionth of an inch. Let me drop. And the bottom line is that antenna has, I forget the exact number, but it's something like 156 decibels of gain as an antenna. You put your laser pointer at the eyepiece of that Mount Palomar telescope, and it's got 156 decibels of gain as an antenna. And you aim that at the moon, and you get, and boy, is that focusing power. And then the echo you get off the moon, you gather again with that 200-inch diameter thing and refocus it back to the focal point where you've got some kind of a detector. Now, in order to properly design a parabolic dish, you want the surface to be mathematically accurate to the parabola. You don't want a whole lot of bumps and grinds in it. There's a very exact three-dimensional shape for the dish itself. And there's a zillion ways you can make the dish, even though it's got the same diameter. You can make it very shallow, that means it's got a long focal length, or you can make it very deep, which means it's got a very short focal length. Each has some advantages and disadvantages. But once you've chosen your particular dish diameter and your particular focal length of your particular dish, how flat or how curved it is, so to speak, then there is an ideal feed horn that you use in front of that dish. Let me drop. For a whole bunch of crazy reasons, to get maximum gain out of the dish, you will design a feed horn that at your favorite frequency, its phase center is right at the focal point of the dish. Every parabola has got a very sharp focal point right out in front of it. You're going to put your feed horn right at that focal point, and the feed horn is going to have just the right beam width so it takes your transmitter power, and you try to evenly smear it across that whole surface of the parabolic dish. If you could evenly put all of your power across every square centimeter of that dish and do it all in phase, equal power everywhere on the dish, and the power abruptly falls to zero out at the edge so you don't have any spillover, that will give you the maximum gain you're going to get out of that area, out of that dish. Okay? To do that, to have that much control of the antenna pattern, azimuth, elevation, power output in those directions, to have that much control requires a phased array cluster feed horn. The feed horn would look like a fly's eye to do that. If your frequency is high enough, with individual elements of the fly's eye are small enough, you could do that. For a whole bunch of reasons, in most cases, you've only got enough room and enough resources to make one simple feed horn. When you have one simple feed horn, it's going to have a Gaussian-shaped antenna pattern. The pattern is going to have a bore sight that you aim right at the center of the dish, and it's going to fall off as you go at various angles away from the bore sight of the feed horn. That's called the primary pattern. The signal is going to get weaker. When you study all of the geometry involved in the finite area of your particular feed horn, you'll discover that when you design the feed horn so that the edge of the dish is...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
If your feed horn lights up the dish in such a way that the edge of the dish is 10 decibels weaker in signal than the apex of the dish, the center of the dish, that's usually the criteria where you get the maximum gain. You can use a broader feed horn where the edge of the dish is only 3 dB down, but now a lot of energy spills over the edge and is wasted. You can design a feed horn which is very narrow in its beam width, where you're putting a real hot spot in the middle of the dish, but you're putting no energy out at the perimeter. Well, you're wasting all that area. If you don't put any signal on it, you might as well cut it away. You're just creating more wind load. When you look at the compromise, the trade-off, 10 dB down at the edge of the dish, including the extra distance to the edge called space loss. You put that all together. If the edge of your dish is illuminated 10 dB down, you're getting the maximum gain out of one simple feed horn. Okay? Now, as you start putting an iris in front of the feed horn, let me drop. In the case of your human eye, where your eye is a large number of wavelengths in diameter at the optical frequencies, your eye is, when your pupil is fully dilated at night, your eye is around 5 to 7 millimeters of diameter of your iris. And the wavelengths you're using are 530 nanometers. So if I put that together, I forget how many thousands of wavelengths, but you have thousands of wavelengths of diameter of your iris at the optical frequency. Your eye as a antenna has 65 decibels of gain. Your eye really is, to some degree, it's a very miniaturized Mount Palomar telescope. It's got 60 some odd dB of gain. So closing down the iris, closing down your eyelid, when you're working with something that is thousands of wavelengths in diameter, gives you a very specific antenna pattern out there. But now let's go back to the real world. In the RF world, where your feed horn is in the vicinity of one or two wavelengths in diameter, not thousands of wavelengths in diameter, you start putting an iris in front of that feed horn. The main thing that happens is you'll create standing wave ratio into its feed line, into its transmission line. At first, you'll have very little change in the pattern out of the feed horn. All you're really doing is acting as an attenuator. You could put a variable attenuator in the transmission line instead of putting an iris out in front of a horn, and you'd be doing almost the same thing. So the rate at which you change the primary pattern of a feed horn by putting an iris in front of it, and you use your optical past knowledge, your optical experience, where your optics of your
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
When I use the 45 degree mirrors in an optical periscope, when I use lenses in front of a camera, when I talk about the iris and the lens of a human eye, you're talking about an optical system where the components you're using are many thousands of wavelengths in diameter. That makes things act very differently. And you'd like to believe that if I simply hop over to the radio world, where I've got this parabolic dish and the feed horn in front of it, that it acts the same way. It doesn't. You have to recognize the fact that you're working with very small number of wavelengths, and as such, the beam width of the feed horn tends to be very broad to begin with if you don't do something with the way you flare the edges of that horn in order to narrow up its beam width. And so the iris doesn't do what you think it's going to do. You think you're going to, with the iris, you're going to light up only the top of the dish versus the bottom of the dish, or the right-hand side versus the left-hand side. Well, it won't work that way. As you start closing down that iris, which is only a fraction of a wavelength in diameter, you're going to get diffraction effects around the edge of the iris. You're still smearing RF energy across that dish. You're creating more standing wave ratio to the transmission line, and you're not changing the pattern by anywhere near the amount that you think you are. In order for you to decide to squirt all of your RF energy to the right-hand side of the dish and put none to the left-hand side of the dish, you'd have to make a very high-gain feed horn, which has got a very narrow beam width, and then you physically rotate, pivot that feed horn to the right-hand side of the dish. It would take many wavelengths of diameter of the mouth of the feed horn to give you the directivity of the radio wave in three space, the primary pattern, to give you the
repeater, timeout, cancel.
So let me repeat that. It has to have many wavelengths of diameter of the mouth of the feed horn in order to have narrow enough directivity, a narrow enough beam width in the primary pattern of the feed horn, so that you would have the ability to aim it at the right-hand side of the dish and not put any radio energy into the left-hand side of the dish. By the way, when you did that, be steering the beam that comes off the parabolic dish. No matter how you emit the energy from the vicinity of the focal point of the dish, no matter how that energy strikes the reflecting surface of the parabolic reflector, that geometry dictates what direction in space the final beam will go to. And you swishing that feed horn left and right and up and down, because it's a very narrow beam with feed horn, you will change what part of the dish is getting RF energy. For the most part, you will not be steering the resultant beam that comes out of that dish. Ain't that crazy? KC2WGB, K2LIW in the Tech Man.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick, but if we didn't have the iris initially set up, if we had it outside of the feed horn, beyond it, and we used it that way, say, in receiving, would the same technical points still apply?
I can start off with a high-performance parabolic dish antenna with a so-called primary feed, not an offset-fed feed. So I've got a feed horn right at the focal point, laid out in the center of the dish, out in front, and the dish is working like a charm. And now I can decide to hold pieces of sheet metal in various places between the feed horn and the parabolic dish. And I hold various pieces of sheet metal with various angles, so that now the incoming signal hits my sheet metal and reflects off to some other crazy direction in space and doesn't get a chance to go back to the feed horn in focus, in phase, and so on. By doing that, I can knock down the performance of the dish. I'm creating, as far as the incoming planar wave is concerned, I'm casting a shadow on that planar wave, hitting my pieces of sheet horn, and no longer getting a chance to hit the parabolic dish where it gets focused and comes back to the feed horn. So I can knock down the efficiency of the dish by putting various pieces of random size and directed pieces of sheet metal between the feed horn and the dish. Why would you want to do that? If you've got a beautiful operating dish, why would you want to knock down its efficiency, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Well, Dick, if we took, instead of going between the feed horn and the dish, if we were to take the iris in front of the whole assembly and close the iris slowly, what's happening to the signal and what change in efficiency is that dish going to experience?
Okay, let's assume now I've got a 10-foot diameter dish with a 10-foot focal length. And 15 feet out in front of the whole parabolic dish assembly, I'm creating an iris. I've got a piece of sheet metal on the left, a piece of sheet metal on the right, and I'm starting to bring them together. The slot in the middle between the two pieces of sheet metal is going to zero. The 10-foot diameter dish, I'm rounding out the numbers here, under normal circumstances, is gathering something close to 100 square feet of incoming signal. And with the iris I put out in front, I'm now going to allow it to see not 100 square meters, 100 square feet, 90, 80, 70, 60. I can, in a linear manner, knock down the gain of the antenna by closing that iris that's way out in front. So all I'm doing is knocking down the gain, knocking down the magnitude of the signal that I receive and or transmit, because it'll obey reciprocity. And by the way, just putting the sheet metal there, even though it's in the receiving mode, because of the amount of area of that sheet metal, of the iris you're creating out in front, and the way the dish focuses, when you do your measurements at that feed horn, you will see an increase in the standing wave ratio at the transmission line going to the feed horn because of the irising phenomena that you're putting 15 feet out in front of the dish. Ain't that crazy? You will be changing the visor of the antenna, knocking down its efficiency. Efficiency, now you got to be careful. You're knocking down the amount of signal. Let me drop. You're knocking down the amount of signal it can gather. You're knocking down the measured gain of the system. I don't see how you get any benefit from doing that. It's an interesting experiment that will show you the relationship between effective capture area and gain. The bedrock formula for the antenna science is gain equals 4 pi a over lambda squared. 4 pi is a constant, roughly 12.6. A is the effective area of your antenna, and lambda squared, lambda is the wavelength at which you're operating. So you tell me how much area your antenna has in effective area, you tell me the wavelength you're working at, you plug it into that formula, it tells you exactly what gain you're going to get. The 4 pi and the lambda squared, if you're not switching the frequency, the lambda squared is a constant, the 4 pi is a constant. The bottom line is gain is a constant times area. Your iris is changing the effective area of the antenna. You use the iris to knock down the effective area of the antenna by a 2-to-1 ratio. You will, as a hard number, get 1/2 the amount of gain, which when you convert it to decibels is 3 dB less gain. So you've got by using that iris, you've now got a gain control where you can knock down the number of decibels of gain your antenna used to have. I'm not sure why you'd want to do that, but you could if you want to as an experiment, and you would be reproving that that formula is telling you the truth. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, very good, Dick. Don't understand why he was asking the question, but apparently he's interested in how the dish actually works, and the iris making linear closure on that dish, like you said, 3 dB loss. Very interesting. I don't know if he's going to be able to do this with the equipment he has, but it'll be fun. Well, that's about it from the mailbag, and very interesting answers. Thank you. KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
He's got a couple of different ways he could be doing this phenomenon, John. He could be using the iris way out in front of the dish and open and close it, making the gain go up and down. If he was willing to sacrifice the dish, he would find out that closing the iris, which closes the amount of effective capture area on reception, because the iris is casting a shadow, is going to give him very similar to the same performance change as if he walks over to the parabolic reflector, which is made out of thin sheet metal. He walks over there with his chainsaw. He starts chopping away pieces of the parabolic dish with his chainsaw. He's going to be knocking down the gain in a predictable manner. So whether he does it with the iris way out in front, or whether he does it with the chainsaw out back, he's going to get fairly similar performance change of what is the new area versus the old area, and therefore you can predict how many decibels less gain you're going to get, or how many dBm, dB with reference to a milliwatt, of less signal power you're going to receive as you start cutting down the area of your receiving antenna. One of the things that's hard to believe is that every antenna we use fits that exact formula. Gain is 4 pi a over lambda squared. That 80-meter dipole that you and I have used many times in our life, 132 feet long piece of wire, and whether you make a 26-gauge wire or 12-gauge wire, almost doesn't matter. The 132-foot length of wire at its resonant length, when it's receiving a broadside signal that's horizontally polarized, co-polarized with the wire, if your eye could see what that antenna is doing, you would see a great big oval black area in space around that dipole, where the major axis of the oval would be parallel with the major axis of the wire of the dipole, and that black area would have an area of 8,500 square feet. Your 80-meter dipole, mounted at a reasonable altitude, is capturing 3.75 megahertz signals from an area of space that equals 8,500 square feet. That simple little piece of wire that casts a shadow on the ground at high noon of 1 or 2 square feet has a radio area of 8,500 square feet if and only if it is resonant. Do something to knock that wire of that dipole out of resonance far enough, its effective capture area will come down from 8,500 square feet down to the couple of square feet you get of the shadow it casts on the ground. Simply knocking it out of resonance goes from 8,500 down to 1. Do you see the magic of resonance when it comes to an antenna? You're starting to get a feel for why I have been shouting,
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
You're starting to get a feel for why I've been shouting all these years, if you want an antenna to work well, you will resonate it first, then it can radiate. 8,500 versus 1. In the case of an 80-meter dipole, that's what you gain. Let's see how you feel about that one, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the tech band.
Well, Dick, that sure enforces the value you give to residents. You look at that from 8,000 square feet to the measurement of the shadow on the ground. Oh, my God. Yeah, it's just fantastic. So apparently, if he had a 10-foot dish and he put the iris in front of it and reduced it to half of that, it would be the same as if he had a 5-foot dish. I guess that's what he's trying to understand. But great answers. And let's go on to Paul, KC2WGB.
Hold on now, John. If I go from a 10-foot diameter dish to a 5-foot diameter dish, I have half the diameter, I have half the radius, area is 4 pi r squared. You half the diameter, you got one quarter of the area. You've lost 6 dB of gain. So be careful on how you, had you said if I half the area, I go down to half the power, yes. But you half the diameter, you got one quarter of the area, one quarter of the power, you lose 6 dB. We better correct that before we get the lead guy down a bad path here, John. Back to you, John, K2LAW.
Well, if he has this thing and he can actually get it to work, I'm sure he's going to be, he'll have some interesting measurements. I hope he gets back in touch. I don't think his dish is 10, but it looks like it could be 8. So that'll be an interesting iris also.
You don't have a guess, John, as to why he wants to put an iris in front of a dish or in front of a horn, do you?
Well, he thinks it's going to help with the directivity, actually with signal to noise. That's what his, that's what he leads me to think in his little paragraph here.
Yeah, there's a small number of ways to make a parabolic dish work well. There's a zillion ways you can destroy it. Putting random pieces of sheet metal around as far as the antenna is concerned, an iris out in front, an iris between the feed horn and the dish and whatever, you do any of those things, you're going to develop stronger side lobes, a weaker main lobe, a broader main lobe. You're going to degrade the front-to-back ratio. That is a method of getting rid of undesired interference. Is a tough way to go. Is a much better way to go. In the early days of what's it now called, community antenna television system, say for instance you and I lived in a valley between two mountains, John, and over the hill of one of those mountains is a beautiful broadcast station, and you and I want to receive that. Okay, so on the top of that mountain, we set up an antenna aimed at that broadcast station. And by some means, we bring that signal down into our valley and distribute it to our customers. Okay? That works very well. But now that you've got the antenna on top of the mountain, it's not only seeing the desired broadcast transmitter that's to the west, it's also seeing, when you get band openings, some other broadcast transmitter coming in from the southwest. In other words, you want to listen, you and I are on a mountain on Long Island. No, we're on a mountain in Staten Island. We're on the east side of Todd Hill. And we put up an antenna on the top of Todd Hill aimed to the west. strong signal from central New Jersey. And occasionally you get a band opening where a signal starts coming in from Maryland. It comes into the side lobes of your antenna and gives us co-channel interference. Let me drop. And there's something that these guys have created called a co-channel interference eliminator. When that signal on the exact same frequency from Maryland happens to get out of its normal range because of the band opening and comes up to Todd Hill at its crazy angle of arrival, comes into the side lobe of our antenna and gives us herringbone and the pictures of the old-fashioned amplitude modulated television signals of the old days. And the customers start complaining, hey, your community antenna TV system is giving me a pretty yucky looking picture. And I hear these funny squiggling sounds in the sound. Okay. What you do to eliminate that is that after doing some testing, you'll find out that the side lobe of your antenna aimed towards central New Jersey has a certain amount of performance in the direction of Maryland where the signal sometimes comes from. Let's assume that it's 10 dB down. You take a second antenna on top of the mountain, a tiny little antenna usually, aimed toward Maryland. It picks up the Maryland signal. You now mix the Maryland signal in a summing device after the main antenna and arrange it so that the two signals coming into the main antenna from Maryland and to your auxiliary antenna aimed at Maryland, you set it up so that those two signals arrive at the output of the summing device 180 degrees out of phase. You've done canceling. That's called a co-channel interference eliminator. When you have a finite number of known directions where an undesirable signal is going to arrive sometimes, and you intentionally set up by an auxiliary antenna on a summing network where you carefully adjust amplitude and phase so that you know the signal when it arrives, and the process of putting in that device that I just described only hurts your performance by 1 dB of the main operation of the antenna aimed towards central New Jersey.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
That's the method that has been used in the past to get rid of undesired interference. Does that seem to make some sense, John? KC2WGB, K2LAW in the tech net.
Oh, absolutely, Dick. That sounds like a great system that would work. 180 degrees out of phase. Perfect. But I have another issue with what he's trying to do, because I'm worried about when he puts this piece of metal in front of the dish, he's going to take the signal approaching the rear of the dish and reflect it into the face of the dish. So he may pick up more than he eliminates, if that's what he's trying to do.
Yeah, if this was the optical world, where all of your components are thousands of wavelengths in diameter, we all know how that works. You've got a light in the ceiling coming down to the newspaper. You hold your hand in a certain position. You cast a shadow onto the newspaper, and you can make portions of the newspaper turn dark because you're operating with objects of thousands of wavelengths at the optical frequencies you and I use. You start doing that in the radio world, where the number of wavelengths of your devices is very small. They behave in a peculiar manner. That sheet metal out in front, just like you said, is going to take some of the signal from the back lobe, where ordinarily the parabolic dish, when it's working correctly, probably has a 35 decibel front-to-back ratio. And now you're going to take some of that signal that would have been 35 dB rejected by the dish itself, and you're going to reflect it off that iris sheet metal out front and now ram it into the front of the dish, so to speak. Most likely that's going to hurt more than it helps. So, the way radio signals tend to fold around objects that are small in wavelengths is very different than the shadows that you and I see in the optical world. Radio behaves differently. You have to think much, much bigger wavelengths or much, much smaller shadowing devices in order to see what the diffraction effects are like, and that's what we're talking about here, diffraction. A signal can be reflected, refracted, and diffracted. And we're discussing diffraction right now. KC2WGB, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Electronics just gets more fascinating as you look at these different topics. magnet. It gets to be very complicated. All right, that's about it from the mailbag. Pleasure. And back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Area
stuff that was sent by Earth. So I'm not very happy with that. They really built this nice. You open it up, and it's also another room temporarily while it's attached, which means it has lighting, it has fire detection, it has fire suppression. It's a regular living module. So it adds another little room to the space station while it's attached for the next 3 weeks. So it will separate from the space station and return to the Pacific Ocean, drop it. March 25th, a week or two out from now, and it'll be bringing back scientific equipment and other stuff that they can't bring back with the other supply vehicles that go up there. And the only other vehicle that they can bring anything back on is the Soyuz spacecraft. And when that comes back, it's got three people attached to it, and not much more room after that to bring their equipment back. And that does return to Kazakhstan. The whole Russian component to sending people back. The Russians also have a supplied spacecraft, which brings up about the same amount of weight as SpaceX Dragon. And that also attaches to the Russian side of the International Space Station. And after a couple of maybe a month or two up there, what they use that for is a operation called Dravid. So unlike the Dragon spacecraft, this thing doesn't take all the garbage and things that they don't need anymore, because this does not return to Earth. They've sent up about 50 of these things to the space station. The launch of the first two components back in 1999, and it comes back, and they burn it up over the Pacific Ocean, so that becomes a garbage disposal unit, as well as the Japanese version, the H2, and the European Space Agency has their own resupply vehicle, which is much bigger than the rest of them. They bring up about at least three or four times the amount of payload space station. But again, it's another garbage disposal unit. It stays up there for a long period of time. They load it up and burn it up over the Pacific Ocean. This WS2N. Give Dick a chance to go on before we go to part two. WS1 space part of the net.
Very fine, Paul. Diamond, what's going on? I had a failure of one of my Kenwood 7-Elevens after all these years. Goodness, good thing I've got two of them. Please continue, Paul. KQLIW.
Understood. Very good, huh? What do you expect? Every 30 years or so, you got to do a repair job. Very good. On that radio, I've heard you talk a lot about that. Okay, that's pretty much for the Dragon. And then, not related, but another topic dealing with what they believe is the first photograph of an exoplanet. They took a picture of this thing, I think it's some 350 light years from Earth. And they were actually able to get a picture. And the group that did it wasn't Hubble. It's actually taken by the European Southern Observatory down in Chile. That's the same place where that punk fellow works. He built that amplifier you always talk about, power supply. What is he's involved with? But I know when he was written up, he works for this being Southern Observatory down. It's called the Very Large Telescope in Chile, and they've got a picture of this planet
probably a little bit bigger than Jupiter. And going around a star. It's not going to be too long that we're going to have a telescope that's going to be able to actually photograph a planet going around a star. And he was actually talking about an Earth-type planet, but they get pretty close. So maybe with the James Webb Space Telescope launched in 2018, they'll be able to have something that might be able to do that. One other topic I just wanted to bring up, we talked about the launch of the Van Allen probe back in August of last year. Let me drop it. Quite well. These were twin space probes, you might remember them. They were launched by an Atlas V rocket. And they're in a very high elliptical orbit. And the reason for it is to pick up both Van Allen belts. You have two Van Allen belts. One of them start around 1,000 miles up, and then they go a little higher than that. And then there's another group that starts around 12,000. That probably goes to the 20,000 mile area above the surface of the Earth. So to do that, they have the two space probes flying in tandem around the Earth, and they come down to around 300 miles, and they go up to, you know, the 20,000 mile area. And in doing that, they're able to pick up all the different readings from the different Van Allen belt areas. And they're able to do this. Most spacecraft really can. Let me drop it. That, you know, although spacecraft are built with a lot of protection from ionizing radiation or different kinds of radiation, these two space probes are really built for, you know, they're really designed, specially designed electronics to handle that special shielding built around it. So, their first 3 years or so, and then they'll have an extended mission after that. It's all going to be going in and out of the Van Allen belt. And already they've come across some discoveries. They found a third belt, although it didn't last long. It came and then it went. So they're making discoveries all the time. You know, where this third belt come from, how come it showed up, how come it left, and does it happen all the time? We drop it. Happen, you know, every maybe once a year to every 10 years, you know, every 100 years, whatever. We want to know where it came from, how it was developed. They got some ideas. But these two Van Allen probes, formerly known as they were radiation belt storm probes, but after it got into orbit, they renamed it the Van Allen probe. After the discoverer of the Van Allen. They've known about these belts since the Explorer 1, the first successful launch of an American orbital spacecraft back in the late 1950s. So they named it after him. It took me a long time to figure out why two probes. I had to go to a lot of different websites, especially. I came up with the answer. I'm dropping. Two probes go around at some parts of the orbit that are quite far apart. Then other times they come quite close together, maybe 70 miles apart. And because they have identical instruments on board, when they're far apart, they get an overall view of what's going on at any particular moment. Van Allen belt. But then when they come close together, they get detailed imagery, if you want to call it that, with their detectors of specific locations in the Van Allen belt. So finally came across that. And we'll follow that for the next couple of years. A couple other comments. Dick, last week you mentioned the they wanted to build another rover could see that, but there's also another one on the drawing board. Drop it. European Space Agency is into this. They have the XL Mars Trace Orbiter and also the rover. XL Mars Orbiter and rover. Two different flights. One will just, as it goes near Mars, it's going to separate. It's going to have a lander. And that will just land in one location. They call that the XO Mars Trace Orbiter. And then the other one will, the other part of it will go into orbit. And they'll take a lot of reading. They want to find out the different gases and things like that that might be still in the atmosphere of Mars. We have a similar flight going up at the end of the year called the MAVEN. NASA is launching. It's going to do something similar to that. It's not going to be a lander, but an orbiter. And also, eventually, a repeater. Let me drop it. WS2N. Later on, maybe 2 years after the Echo Mars Trace gas orbiter, they're going to have the Exo Mars rover land on the planet, separate, completely different flight. Both flights being pretty much done by the European Space Agency. NASA is involved with a lot of the detecting equipment, and it's really a consortium of countries involved. Other countries are making detecting parts for the rover. And it's going to be launched by Proton rocket. That means Russia. Proton rockets are built by Russia. The rover is not a, does not have a radiation on, a generator on board. It's not like Curiosity. So, no RTG. But it does have solar panels, so it's more similar to the other one, the Spirit or Opportunity, but bigger. Let me drop it. That's pretty much it. Kind of put 2 weeks together here. That's why it's kind of long. That just want to bring up the comment that I was telling John about earlier before tonight. They call that Pan Stars. It's a comet that's going to be visible, but you need a good westerly view because it's going to be occurring at sundown. So, you know, the comets are usually seen best when they're getting closer to the sun, so its tail will be, if you look to the west, the sun is just below the horizon. That would be the core of the comet that you would see, and then the tail would be rising straight up, and that'll be covering around the, actually a couple of days, I'll start on the 12th, 2 days from now, and you should be able to see it every night, or right before night, in the west sky, all the way till March 24th, the only problem is, you know, it's not going to be quite really dark, so you're going to need clear skies, a clear westerly view, because it will be low to the horizon. Drop it. At the same time, because it's already in the western horizon, the Earth is moving, and you'll see it for about a half hour, and then the comet itself will set. We'll go close to the horizon, so you got roughly a half hour every night. So maybe somebody will get to see it. I don't have a good westerly view. So I'll try to maybe go to a parking lot or something. Try to give it a shot one of those nights on a clear night. That's it for the space report, Dick. I'll stand by for any questions. K2RIW. This is WS2N.
Two questions for you.
Are you fine? No. Paul, John recognized with his questions, and I found out what the error was here. The exoplanet that was viewed by the European Southern Observatory, do you happen to know which of their telescopes they did it with, and how far away is that exoplanet? The guy who worked there, a technician who I was keeping in good contact with, is XQ2FOD, X-ray Quebec number 2, Foxtrot, Oboe, Delta, Manfred Mornhenway. Real interesting guy, and he had that article in QST magazine, the December 1999 was the first half, and January 2000 was the second half of the article of this extremely high performance 12 volt switching power supply, 40 amperes. Starts off with 120 volts, and out comes 40 amperes with very high efficiency of 12 volts, 13.8 volts, if you know what I mean. So Manfred was the guy. That's the good news. Manfred no longer works for them. They were about to transfer him to the Atacama Plain, which is where they're putting up this new millimeter wave. Is it millimeter wave? I think, it's a millimeter wave radio telescope. The largest millimeter wave radio telescope in the world is being constructed in the Atacama Plain, which is, I don't know the exact distance, probably 50 or 100 miles further away on a much higher mountain. I think that mountain is something like 14,000 feet. It's a very difficult place to live. It's kind of life-threatening. And he didn't want to do that. So he quit. And he no longer works for the European Southern Observatory. And so I got to write him some more letters.
Repeater, time out, cancel.
I've got to write him some more letters to find out what he's doing. So when it comes back to you, Paul, I'm going to be asking you how far away is that exoplanet that they viewed, and what telescope do you think they did with it, you did use to do that. John, go right ahead with your question. KC2WGB, K2RAW, the sixth answer.
Thank you, Dick. Yes, Paul, I'd like to know how SpaceX missed the fact that they had no pressurization in two containment vessels at launch. Why did they have to wait to MECO? That's one question. The second question is about the Soyuz. Do they have more than one landing site available? I know Kazakhstan, but is there any other place in the world that they have as a secondary landing point? I've never heard them landing anywhere else but there. Maybe you can enlighten me on that. KC2WGB, over to you.
Okay, yeah, they're pretty good at landing there. Years ago, they used to miss. One time they wound up in a black forest. Middle of a snowstorm, and the Russian crew had to wait about 3 days before they were rescued. But as far as I know, that's the only location. I mean, it is safe for them to land in the water, but they have to have a ship nearby. So far, so good, though, but they were, I mean, they got better at it, of course, as time went on. They wound up downrange she was on board, and thrusters didn't fire right for deorbit, and they wound up way downrange. Like they got a little, she got a little hurt on that one, so that was a problem. You know, I mean, they got it, but not 100%. No other deserts or anything like that that they plan on ever coming down on. The area that they're talking about is huge. Kazakhstan is a big location. No problem there. Problem is, you know, if they misfire, they could come down somewhere else, like the forest somewhere. Drop it. And as far as the planet that you were talking about, it's about the Jupiter size, around 300, this is 320, I didn't write it down, but it was around 325 light years from Earth. That gives you an idea. Sirius is eight light years. Nearest star is Alpha Centauri at 4.3 or something like that. Got a Lyra. I think that's 20. Vega in the Lyra system is around 25 light years. This one's about a little over 300. And it's about the size of the planet, it's about the size of Jupiter. And John, I forgot the other thing. The Russian component and one other thing, John. What was that?
SpaceX with the pressurization of those vessels.
Oh, that's right. Okay, well, you know, there's four sets of thrusters, so when they got up there, they realized that they lost pressure in three. But I mean, they lost it. They must have had it. They must have knew it was good, the sensors, before they launched. Trying to remember. I think there was a valve that closed. Something they were able to naturally do it from Hawthorne, California. They were able to correct this problem, sending signals up, and they probably either opened a valve or maybe another valve, you know, a bypass type of thing. I haven't read any details on that, but I'm sure they were pressurized before they left. Otherwise, they wouldn't have taken off. It's interesting, they have the solar panels that come out right after they launch. So, pretty good. Yeah. Solar panels collapse back down when they leave, and then they separate the panels from the spacecraft itself. When you see the panels and the thrusting units actually separate after they deorbit, just the capsule part comes down. So they'll never get a chance to look at these thrusts. I don't think the ones I'm thinking about on what I would call the service module part of that system. There's other thrusters on board the capsule itself. They're actually called pusher rockets. There's an emergency.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
These pusher rockets could be used for, if there's an emergency, you have a crew on board, they can fire these rockets and it'll actually pull itself away from, or actually push itself away from the secondary stage. In case there's an emergency, they could also use these rockets for other things. But they're not the real maneuvering rockets. That's a good company. I mean, if you look up the SpaceX and see what they're doing, I mean, their eventual plan is to have this capsule, this SpaceX, go back into space. They haven't done it yet. Everyone that's gone up, this is their third flight to the International Space Station, their fourth flight to space. Each one has been a new spacecraft. Their goal is to recycle these things and to have you know, one particular spacecraft go up 10 different times, and they have the capability of landing on land, and they want to be able to do that, and with high precision. That's part of his goal. He says he won't consider himself successful unless he can do that. And other things, the booster, he's working on that. You got to see the video on that. Let me drop it. This is a rocket stage. It looks like a Falcon 9. It's probably a Falcon 1. That's what it looks like. The reason they call it a Falcon 9, it's really nothing but